Hello, and welcome to this episode of SAS Space Power Discussions. My name is Major Michael Sayers. I go by Nike, and I'm an F-22 pilot. I'm joined by my colleague from the Indian Air Force, Wing Commander Reddy. Reddy, why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself?
I'm Wing Commander Karthik Reddy from Indian Air Force, and I'm a Mirage 2000 pilot.
Beginning with a disclaimer, the listening audience should know that all opinions expressed here are our own and not necessarily representative of the Department of Defense, the Air Force, or any other affiliated organizations. So this episode is part of a larger series of space power discussions where students from the School of Advanced Air and Space Studies consider space power and strategy. Today, we will be taking a deep dive into a book titled GPS Declassified: From Smart Bombs to Smartphones by Richard Easton and Eric Fraser. Reddy, why don't you go ahead and introduce our first author?
Okay, Nike. The first author of the book is Richard Easton. He has published various articles about the origins of GPS itself and also space-related publications. He holds a master's from the University of Chicago, and he's uniquely suited to discuss this topic because his father, Roger Easton, led the space applications branch at the Naval Research Laboratories.
Okay, well, the second author is Eric Fraser, and he is an independent writer, editor, and book reviewer. He specializes in science and technology mostly, but he also writes about business, health, and education. His interests include the study of maps and geospatial studies, which makes him really well suited to the topic of today's discussion. With that, we'll go ahead and move on to the book itself. So GPS Declassified is a historical narrative which tracks the initial development of GPS and how it has matured over time and ended up resulting in the ubiquitous system that we know of today. Overall, the main purpose of the book is to describe how technology initially started in the lab, moved to the battlefield, and then proliferated to everyday use by the civilian population. Reddy, why don't you go ahead and give us a little bit of historical context behind the development of GPS?
The historical arc which the book presents is, I think, really comprehensive. It starts with the early concepts of satellite navigation itself and also takes us through the entire realm of space race starting from launch of Sputnik. The authors do a good job of introducing celestial navigation and also various technologies which are intimately linked to the GPS development as such, like radar, bistatic antennas and radars, and the technologies related to timation and also signal structures. They also tell us how Project Vanguard, often remembered for its failure in 1957, actually contributed significantly to how GPS would later be built on.
Perfect. So like Reddy mentioned, the original problem that scientists were trying to solve in the early days of the space race was how to track satellites in space. Early on in the development, there were several competing systems that were developed based on a variety of technologies. And the book does a good job of discussing four of these programs. So they're called Minitrack, Transit, Timation, and Project 621B. So I'll just give a quick overview of those systems for context. But moving on to Timation, which is short for Time Navigation, this program started in 1964, and it was a collaboration between Roger Easton from the Naval Research Lab, or NRL, and Dr. Arnold Shostak from the Office of Naval Research, ONR for short. This system utilized atomic clocks inside the satellites, which were able to synchronize the ground transmitter and receiver clocks. And this is really the first space-based navigation system. The biggest competitor to Timation was Project 621 Bravo, which was an Air Force project. It also started in 1964. All right, at this point, the book illuminates how there were some discrepancies really in the historical record surrounding the origin of GPS. And some people claim it was Timation, and then others say 621 Bravo was the first or the primary. Reddy, why don't you shed some light on this problem?
The major part of this book is to apportion credit to who was really responsible for the GPS constellation being what it is today. So they go into both the systems, which is the Timation, which is the naval project, and also the 621 Bravo. And they also go into the detailed timelines of how these systems came into being and how these two systems were merged while utilizing ground stations and orbital mechanics being picked up from the Timation project, which finally resulted in the 55-degree inclination polar orbits, which GPS uses today, and also using the spread spectrum band of signal structure, which was originally proposed in the Project 621B.
That's perfect, because There was a lot of inter-service rivalry going on, right? Time-Ation being a Navy program mostly, and 621 being Air Force, and everybody had their own interests in developing the system. So they really had to compromise over time, right? Yeah, so we put GPS in the geopolitical context of the Cold War, and then really specifically in the space race between the U.S. and the Soviet Union. But really what I think is one of the best parts as we continue our summary is how they put GPS in the context of navigation innovation and invention over time. So in addition to the navigational innovation, what you also see is how timing innovations over time contributed to navigation. All right, so now we've talked about navigation, we've talked about timing. We're going to transition a little bit to how the military initially wanted to use this, but it ended up being heavily incorporated into civilian use over time. So the book talks about how President Reagan gets the credit for making GPS accessible, but I think Easton and Frazier argue that this is really more urban legend than historical fact. Reddy, why don't you explain that?
Yes, Nike. The common narrative claimed that President Ronald Reagan personally declassified GPS or issued an executive order to make GPS available for civilian use, especially following the Korean Airlines Flight 007 incident, where the airlines drifted almost 200 nautical miles from the air route and ended up over the Sakhalin Islands and was shot down by the Russian surface-to-air missiles. But both the authors, through their research, bring out that this was not due to a knee-jerk reaction, but the civilian use was not new or sudden. It had been a part of the broader considerations for GPS from its inception days. They go into detail regarding the Secretary of Defense, then Secretary of Defense in 1973, William P. Clements, who had directed the military services to incorporate civilian needs into the GPS program from its inception itself. And this account is also a reminder to critically examine popular narratives, especially surrounding these key technologies.
Perfect. Yeah, so in line with that, there were a couple critical events in the historical timeline. Like you mentioned, the Korean Airlines flight, but also the Persian Gulf War was surprisingly pivotal in how the technology developed over time too. So some folks have called the Persian Gulf War the first space war, because that's when we really see the U.S. military come to rely on GPS for not only navigation, but for the direction of precision munitions. We also saw the first use of GPS weapons, and the book talks about some of the cruise missiles and smart bombs that were designed for the conflict. They received a fair amount of publicity, but really in the grand context of the war, didn't have too much of an impact because the vast majority of the bombs and the weapons at the time were still unguided munitions. So throughout all of this, a debate began to ensue about whether or not civilians should have the access to high-accuracy position data. Reddy, why don't you explain that debate?
Well, Nike, you'll have to remember that though it was a dual-use technology, it was always meant to be military-first technology. So there was a feature which was built into the technology from its inception itself, which was a selective availability, wherein accuracy was degraded for civilian use, which gave it an accuracy of 50 to 100 meters, which is not so bad. So this was a major problem wherein the civilian users, especially who required precision information to be incorporated into their systems, especially the civil aviation surveys and transportation systems. So this was identified by President Bill Clinton, and in his term in 2000, the selective availability was done away with. And there is a precedence which exists wherein even during the Gulf War, selective availability was turned off so that the partner air forces who were using commercial off-the-shelf GPS systems were able to make use of the technology which was available to the U.S. forces at that point.
All right. So we're going to round out our discussion on the book summary now, and let's talk about where we currently stand with GPS. So GPS has undergone several rounds of modernization over time, really culminating in the fielding of GPS Block 2F and GPS 3. Also, along with this, we see the formalization of some of the bureaucratic elements surrounding GPS. So in 2004, President Bush set up the National Executive Committee for Space-Based PNT, which stands for Position, Navigation, and Timing, which really solidified GPS's role within the government. Okay, so for the remainder of the book, The authors talk about how GPS technology drove innovation with respect to receivers, smartphones, microchips. And it's really interesting to note is that culturally over time, whereas we used to look at GPS probably 20, 30 years ago as the land of opportunity. So how can we integrate this technology to improve our capability, make ourselves more efficient? Where now it is so prolific and so ubiquitous in our culture that we're becoming a little bit concerned about over-reliance. So we've shifted to a mindset of looking at the cost of GPS being disrupted or destroyed, which poses a lot of problems for us. Reddy, why don't you talk about some of the concerns surrounding GPS?
Well, the book, both Easton and Fraser, bring about major concerns with the use of GPS, that is proliferation of GPS. The first concern was regarding safeguarding one's privacy. With billions of smartphones, cars, and other GPS-enabled devices, which multiple devices that we are using every day, the first concern was that a precise location of each and every person who is using that equipment was known to actors who could misuse that information to either track you or put malicious content in either into your hardware that you're using, or maybe may even use your location for unlawful activities. So that was one of the major concerns. However, this also brings about, you know, Nike, you remember the Space Law Stalemate book in which Anya Pekulik brings about the stalemate which exists in space law. I think we need to work on robust terrestrial laws so that we can control the utilization of space on terrestrial domain. So that ties beautifully into whatever they brought out are the various, you know, pitfalls of over-relying on this technology.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And I think it just footstomps that this is still a developing technology and the debate is still ongoing about how we should govern this from a policy standpoint. Okay, so we've talked about the major points of the book. Let's transition to what we really liked about the content of the book. And what I noticed is that the book really centers on three overarching themes. So these themes are the dual-use nature of the GPS system, which we see throughout our space course readings as well. How technology innovation over time occurs, and then finally, concerns about security, over-reliance on individual systems, and the vulnerability of space systems. Let's transition to our critique of the book and our key takeaways.
Clearly, what comes out from our discussion is that the book has a lot to offer Nike. And one of the spheres was that the book reading today feels slightly dated, and maybe in the context of present space 2.0, prolific commercialization of space, the way in which space itself has expanded, the book feels slightly dated, and I think it's a time to come out with the next version of the book. Maybe this is one of the place where I feel a lot of major changes have occurred with the creation of US Space Force and the adoption of space commands in most of the countries, looking at space as a warfighting domain, GPS-3 satellite launches, prolific jamming operations which have been undertaken against GPS at various places, various conflicts that have happened. So all these things, if included in the next version, I think will make the book more holistic.
Yeah, I totally agree. But I also think it's important as it gives us a perspective of how much the space domain has changed just in the last decade, can give us kind of a window into things to come. So let's just take the example of commercial satellite launches. In 2012, there were only 11. And then what we see in 2024, the total amount of commercial satellites that were deployed were close to 2,800. So this boom is really evident in the launch capabilities, in the number of associated commercial space infrastructure companies here. So what I think the book does a good job of is giving a peek into space history, but now history in space is continuing to change at such a rapid pace, it's hard to keep up, at least in the foreseeable future.
This is, I think, one of the issues plaguing contemporary strategists. You know, how do you make or design grand strategy for an environment which is or a landscape where the tech is changing so rapidly? Commonalities between space and cyber in this issue. So I think you bring out a really good point.
So one thing for me about the book that I would critique is that the analysis, I think, sometimes stays at a more introductory level. The authors raise the specter of how GPS technology affects public policy. But at the end of the day, I was left wanting a little bit more depth in the analysis and some discussion on implications. For example, They mentioned concerns about how the GPS industry might influence policy or how dependent we've become on GPS technology, but they don't deeply explore solutions or debates around the issues themselves.
Yeah, absolutely, Nike. I get your point, and I feel the same way, that the analysis could have been more in-depth regarding at least the proliferation of GPS technology, which I feel would have been a good addition, because by the time this book was written, GLONASS was in being, with all the entire constellation being deployed by 1995, and also BeiDou-1, which was a constellation of around 14 satellites, was already operational by 2010. So how they played into the greater strategic narrative of GPS being the lone PNT constellation till that time, which was used globally, and now these new constellations coming in, how that affected the strategic calculus, I think that could have been dealt in slightly more detail.
Yeah, so I think we both agree that GPS Declassified does a good job at making the history of GPS accessible to everyday folks, but they could have expanded on this introductory history to include more strategic analysis as well. None of these critiques ruin the book. I think it is still an excellent history and primer, but there are things an academic reader might note. We both agree that these are areas where future scholarship or a second edition potentially could expand upon. But as it stands, GPS Declassified achieves what they set out to do: give us the origin and story and impact of GPS. Critiques aside, it's a valuable contribution, especially when you read it alongside other space strategy literature, which we're going to talk about right now. If we dive back into the world of space strategy and policy, what's really interesting is how GPS Declassified complements and contrasts with other major readings on space strategy and policy. One theme that immediately jumped out to me is how GPS's story exemplifies what Blood and Bowen calls the original sin of space technology. Bowen argues that space tech was fundamentally developed to enhance the military power, or to quote, to enhance the killing power of the state, as he puts it. So the moon landings and other civilian feats were, in his view, kind of sideshows to the primary driver, which was to use space technology for warfare, intelligence gathering, and increasing a state's political and economic power.
Yeah, Nike, I agree. I think the story of GPS is a textbook case of that thesis. I mean, it started as a secret military project designed to improve precision in war. I think that's the original sin that Bowen talks about. It wasn't made for benefiting humanity at large, but for gaining an edge in warfare. Those were the inceptions of the GPS. But still, it is fascinating that GPS also became a huge boon to mankind. I mean, I would say it is a bit of a redemption story in that regard. Bowen's perspective is, I personally feel that it might be slightly hard-nosed, but GPS is one of those silent workhorses which is shaping global power dynamics today, and the GPS and the book, our book, GPS Declassified, puts flesh on the concept, that showing how a military space project had evolved and spilled over into the civilian realm.
Yeah, really great connection. So Bowen talks about his concept of the cosmic coastline, so viewing orbit as strategic territory. I think that resonates here as well, because GPS satellites essentially patrol a part of that cosmic coastline, albeit in medium Earth orbit, and controlling that constellation gives the U.S. a significant strategic advantage. I think that GPS really fits into his theory of present technologies in space being used to affect policies and results on the ground, thereby further strengthening his cosmic coastline view. Really, the less publicized secondary use of the GPS constellation as integrated operational nuclear detonation detection system, or IONS, also ties into Bowen's narrative of space technology's connection with the original sin.
I think that's an excellent point, Nike. And I think any tale of GPS would be incomplete without mentioning, you know, the larger political, geopolitical context which was reigning at that time. And this was the era of SDI. And GPS was being developed in consonance with SDI. So to put things in perspective, if you go back to Weapons in Space by Aaron Bateman, I think it gives a really good historical perspective of space militarization, which happened in Cold War. And though it focuses specifically on SDI, I think it does a good job of providing perspective when read in parallel with GPS Declassified, which is our work today.
Well, Reddy, I think that brings up the question of, you know, how does SDI and things of this nature tie into GPS? Because I think what we see is that GPS was being developed during that same time period by the Air Force, and it was really a dual-use system, so not a weapon, but a force multiplier. So while SDI was grabbing the headlines in the 1980s as a space weapons initiative, GPS was quietly becoming the military's indispensable navigation grid. And both of these emerged from that intense Cold War competition in space. What Bateman shows us is that the policy debates and technological drivers in this space race, when you read that alongside of GPS declassified, what you see is two faces of space power. So SDI is really aimed at denying enemy capabilities, whereas GPS is designed to enable our capabilities. So before we move on, one could argue that GPS's success and SDI's failure largely show that enabling technologies sometimes win more acceptance than overtly military ones. So the present day evolution of space forces by Russia, China, the USA, and France highlights the importance of military aspects in the space domain and the need to control it, either to influence events on Earth or to prepare for future battles in space as isolated occurrences. We see this in Everett Dolman's Astropolitik, and he provides us a theoretical framework that contrasts really well with the cooperative outcome of GPS. Dolman advocates a very realist, expansionist approach to space strategy, famously suggesting that a power like the U.S. should seize military control of low Earth orbit to dominate space, which I think really aligns well with a continental view of space. He talks about space as the ultimate high ground and argues for a policy of space control. So now, GPS itself is not a weapon, but Dolman would likely view it as a critical piece of infrastructure that a nation must protect and, if possible, monopolize. This is a concept that Dolman calls a technological choke point.
I would agree with a realist perspective of Dolman, you know, because GPS from its inception was a dual-use technology, and Pentagon had the ability to degrade civilian GPS accuracy if needed. And for a time, selective availability was a reality. So I would say that this plays into the realist perspective, and the contrast also raises a question that was GPS made freely available, you know, to strengthen U.S. soft power and economic power by enabling it into the worldwide economic structures. So I think if you look at it from a realist perspective, which I would say that GPS enhances U.S. power on ground, and that is in the terrestrial domain, and also gave it a kind of high ground till the time it was the only navigation satellite system in being.
Already, Dolman would say that is a strategic move, commanding the high ground by making others reliant on your systems.
Indeed. And on that topic of space warfare, I think Klein has been referenced multiple times in our book, GPS Declassified, and his work, Command of Space, was made prolific use of, wherein the authors cite Klein saying that lesser powers might use space to contest the command of space of a global superpower in the space domain. So I think GPS Declassified does a good job of portraying GPS system as one of the space constellation which might be disrupted by a smaller power to take advantage of US's reliance on this space domain. So I think it also nicely plays into Klein's model of thinking in his book about Command of Space.
Yeah, and I think, Reddy, we've already seen some of this stuff play out too, because GPS Declassified notes that after Klein published his book, China actually appropriated the frequency that Galileo had planned to use, which is a real-world instance of spectrum and orbital chess. So if we integrate Klein's theory with the GPS story, it shows us that GPS satellites, while not weapons, are prime targets in a conflict. They're high-value assets.
So, Nike, do you think it is time to delink, you know, critical dual-use technology or infrastructure which had its underpinnings in the original sin, I would say, where they were meant to be dual-use, to declassify them and take them out of state-dependent control and develop a purely commercial global navigation satellite system enterprise or enterprise that can be, you know, reasonably protected to ensure minimal collateral disruptions to at least the civilian use part of it in the event of a major conflict?
Well, it's certainly a discussion that we have to have. And I think we need deeper deliberation on whether it's even possible to de-link civil and military space and move away from space's original sin.
That was a great point, Nike. And so moving ahead, what do you think are the biggest strategic and policy takeaways from all this?
Well, first and foremost, I think we need to recognize that GPS today matters immensely. It's not just some Cold War relic, but it's really the backbone of modern civilization in some ways. In the Air University Space Primer, they say that position, navigation, and timing is a critical part of modern technological infrastructure and a backbone of civil, economic, and defense activities globally. That leads me to the takeaway that we need resilience and redundancy. Policymakers today are actively discussing backup PNT systems because they recognize how critical GPS has become.
Another key takeaway is the importance of maintaining and protecting space infrastructure as a matter of national security, and also developing capabilities to project space power to retain control of space. These have been some of the key ideas which have been proliferating once we talk about control of space with creation of various space forces and space commands. So we've effectively seen space transforming into a new domain of warfighting. And in such a case, protecting GPS satellites from interference, whether from whether through international diplomacy, through technology, I think is a strategic priority.
Yeah, absolutely. In the context of space power, GPS reminds us that not all space assets are about offense. Many of them are enablers, and their effect on war and peace is profound. It has changed how wars are fought and also how economies function, which continues to blur the line between military and civilian spheres. And really, this ties back into the space law stalemate. We need new norms, but they're really hard to come by.
Absolutely, Nike. And I think in an era of great power competition, extending to space, the humble satellite signal guiding your Google Maps is actually part of a larger power play. I mean, reading GPS declassified in tandem with, you know, all the space works that we've discussed in the part of our presentation, it reminds us that being behind the convenience of our smartphones is a story of Cold War strategies, engineering brilliance, strategic dilemmas, and ever-evolving contest to command the high ground of space.
Absolutely. Well, Reddy, thanks for a great discussion, and thanks everybody for listening. If you're interested in space policy, defense strategy, or military history, we highly recommend checking out GPS Declassified and the other works we've mentioned. Collectively, they give us a richer picture of the final frontier's strategic importance. Until next time, stay curious and keep looking up.